Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report, our Women in Agriculture special edition. Today, we'll hear from the brand new dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and the head of rural development for USDA in the great state of Illinois. Stay with us right here on Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our term for the day is futures contract, or just futures. It is a standardized contract between two parties to buy or sell a specified asset of a standardized quantity and or quality for a price agreed upon today, the futures price, with delivery and payment occurring at a specified future date, the delivery date. The contracts are negotiated at a futures exchange, which acts as an intermediary between the two parties. The party agreeing to buy the underlying asset in the future, the buyer of the contract, is said to be long, and the party agreeing to sell the asset in the future, the seller of the contract, is said to be short. While the futures contract specifies a trade taking place in the future, the purpose of the futures exchange institution is to act as the intermediary and minimize the risk of default by either party. Thus, the exchange requires both parties to put up an initial amount of cash, the margin. Additionally, since the futures price will generally change daily, the difference in the prior agreed upon price and daily futures price is settled daily also. That's called variation margin. The exchange will draw money out of one party's margin account and put it into the other so that each party has the appropriate daily loss or profit. If the margin account goes below a certain value, then a margin call is made, and the account owner must replenish the margin account. By the way, the Chicago Board of Trade listed the first ever standardized exchange-traded forward contracts in 1864, which were called futures contracts. This contract was based on grain trading and started a trend that saw contracts created on a number of different commodities, as well as a number of futures exchanges set up around the world. And that's the definition of futures contract.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really. Thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. The College of ACES, the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences here on the Urbana-Champaign campus, has a brand new dean. Her name is Kim Kidwell, and she hails originally from Danville, Illinois, though she spent quite a little bit of time in Washington at Washington State University. I talked to her a little bit about her background. We started with a funny little question. She's a wheat breeder, and I wanted to know why it was that she named one of her varieties of spring wheat Babe.
Oh, gosh, that's such a great story. I named lots of my wheat varieties after people that I love, and I was going to name one after my mom. And she and my dad got in a little bit of a to-do about it. You know, well, why don't you name one after your dad? Well, you should name one after your mom. You should name one after your dad. And my mom and dad called each other Babe for years and years and years and years. And so I actually named that wheat variety Babe after my mom and dad.
Okay, so people will know from here, especially that are listening to the radio station at WLL, they may very well know your mom and dad in Danville. Is that right?
They might. Yeah. My mom's name is Jan Kidwell. And my dad passed away about 12 years ago, but his name was Chuck or Dick Kidwell, depending on who you were talking to and what area he was hanging out in the moment.
How did you decide to become a wheat breeder?
Oh, you know, another funny story just about how life opens up and evolves. I didn't even know what a wheat breeder was when I was in school. And when I came to University of Illinois, I wanted to be in broadcast journalism, actually. So I aspired to be a NFL football broadcaster. That was my goal. And, you know, as life has it, I got interested in other things. But I took a general ed class from a professor in botany. It was John Lonnon, Dr. John Lonnon, who was the guy that resurrected Super Sweet. You know, he got the Super Sweet, Illini Super Sweet corn going. And so he gave a lecture in this general ed class that was just vibrant. And I remember I was sitting up in the back of the room. It was like 300 people in the room. And I thought, boy, I want to like my job as much as that guy likes his job. He's just on fire, and he's talking about corn. So I went down and talked to him after class, and he invited me to come over and see his research lab and talk a little bit about what he does. And I started working with him as an undergrad researcher at that point in time. And I worked with Dr. Lonnon and his wife, Susan Gabalon, and for 3 years. And they got me hooked on plant genetics, and it became my passionate love. And so that's how I ended up being a wheat breeder.
You've released 20 varieties?
About that, probably a little more than that now. You know, the thing about being a breeder, that legacy lives on for a long, long, long time. So I had a very productive program. I worked with lots of farmers. And so when I went to Washington State, I honestly didn't know anything about wheat. I had worked with corn at University of Illinois, and all my graduate work at Wisconsin was on alfalfa. So the job market was pretty bad at that point in time. And I was just kind of practicing interviewing. So WSU called and said, hey, we want you to apply for this job. And I'm like, I don't know anything about wheat. Why would they want me to apply for that job? So I decided, well, I haven't interviewed much, so maybe I'll go practice. And I was very relaxed. So I showed up out there, and I just fell in love with the people and the farmers. And what was so great about that program was it was very much farmer relevant. So when they hired me, they knew I didn't know much about wheat, but they knew I had a good background in genetics and plant breeding. And so I traveled the whole eastern half of the state with farmers for about the first 6 months that I was there. And they just told me all the problems they were having and what they really wanted their wheat breeder to do. And I custom designed that program with their interest in mind. And it revolutionized what we were doing in spring wheat there, and was the smartest decision I ever made, just was to ask what they needed. And it was really helpful. So the program was really productive. And one of my wheat varieties is still the number one spring wheat variety in the Pacific Northwest right now. And it's been in that position for about 10 years.
Which variety is it?
That's Louise.
Nice. What's it named after?
My niece. Yeah. I always called her Louise when she was a little girl, so it was her nickname, and I named that one after her.
You got to learn about Hessian flies and stripe rust and other things, I guess.
Yeah. You know, the beauty of being a wheat breeder is your last success is your next target, and Mother Nature is who you battle every day, so there's always something to do.
How do you want to bring that into College of Aces?
You know, the relevance is the part that I really love and want to have part of my platform as dean. You know, I think the reason to work in a land-grant university is that you want to do things that matter to people. We're the college that does the science that's highly visible in our everyday lives, be it in food, be it in, you know, some of the things we do with families and children, be it with product development and food science and the economic thread that kind of underpins everything. People are highly associated with what we do, and so we need to tell that story a little bit better. You know, the research that we do really matters to society. The students that we train are the next change agents in disciplines that really mean a lot to everyday life and quality of life of people. So that's always been my theme. You know, I loved being a wheat breeder because I knew what was happening with the outcome of those efforts. So I'd see them in farmers' fields, be they in amazing shape or train wrecks. You know, we had some feast or famine experiences with wheat breeding, and I love that it was relevant. You know, I never wondered why I went to work every day. You know, I went to work to make a difference, and I think that's what this college does, and I really want to feature that and highlight that as we move forward.
We've done research. Let's talk about teaching. You've won more than a few awards for teaching, I made note. You must be an excellent prof.
Well, you know, I hope so. That's always the goal. You know, I kind of embodied John Lonnon when I went into the classroom, and I knew that it made a difference how I showed up for students. And so I've always loved using an interactive model, not so much a didactic model where you just talk at students and expect them to regurgitate stuff. So my classes are really interactive, and I like students to work on projects that are kind of real so they can translate the content we're trying to teach them to something that they can remember and something that's meaningful. So I think there's no better honor in academia than to pass the torch to the next generation of experts in our fields. You know, we're all about building legacy and building pipeline. And, you know, for me personally, if I hadn't met John Lonnon, I really don't know where my life would have gone. You know, he was an inspiration and a role model and a mentor to me, and he supported me beyond any measure. You know, he believed in me when I didn't even believe in myself. And I think sometimes you just need somebody to advocate for you. Sometimes students just need to know that they can do it. And I feel like, you know, that's been part of my role, is to have high expectations of what they can do and then support them in getting there. So I frankly, for me, if I didn't have to teach, I don't think I would have gone into academia. It's what I really wanted to do. I was pretty good at it when I was a grad student. And so I thought, well, if people that love to do it should do it. So I think I'll go into academia and give it a go and see what happens.
Tell me about the 205 class.
HD 205. It was just a crazy story. You know, I had been at WSU for a few years, and I realized right away when I took my faculty position that, you know, I was well trained in science. What I wasn't trained in was dealing with people. And I think it's something that we don't do a good job of in general in academia. And so I did some life skill enhancement work in the private sector, and I came out of that training, realized that with a little bit of coaching, the relationships that I built with people would have been different. You know, I think we go on automatic pilot when we're trying to build a relationship with people, and there's some things you can learn and some tools you can use that just makes that better, especially around navigating conflict and differences and building consensus and, you know, just appreciating different types of personalities. So when I came out of the training, I thought, well, you know, I think we should do something for graduate students along these lines, because, you know, the people part of the business is the harder part. The science actually is the easier part in some ways. And so I went back to WSU, and I was pretty excited about developing a grad-level communications course.
Is this related to the Center for Transformational Learning and Leadership?
It is. It built right out of that. So what happened was human development lost an instructor. They had a general ed communications course that needed to be taught. The associate dean of academic programs at that time knew that I wanted to teach a grad course on interpersonal communications, and she called me and said, hey, will you do this at the undergrad level? And I said, sure. So I worked with a life coach from the private sector to build HD 205, and it immediately was a hit. It was kind of amazing. Students really love to be in a place of learning conscious communication skills and practicing it in a interactive environment. So we did a lot of community service projects where they learned how to work with groups of 25 people to do different types of service learning projects. And the goal there was for them to organize in a way they got a lot of things done. And they learned a lot about accountability and about navigating conflict and dealing with personal challenges and being accountable for that and acknowledging people. So that class really still is one of the most popular classes on campus. And it took off so big that we had to hire more instructors to do it. And I trained most of them. And it rolled into, from that undergrad class, we developed some workshops that we did for adult learners, which rolled into an online title leadership certificate program that we launched a couple years ago. And then last year, we just finally created a graduate level online course that I hope to teach here, actually, in about a year. But from that, the work was so successful that we developed a center there, the Center for Transformational Learning and Leadership, which is all about just trying to create opportunities for people in an interactive environment to learn how to be better communicators and how to be better stewards of a relationship with people to improve their results. So it was an amazing journey that just started from me thinking, you know, we should teach students how to do this when they're in school and their stakes are low. So when they get out in the world, they have a better chance of developing good relationships with people and being effective communicators.
It is one of the land grant missions as well, that engagement portion here in the college and across the whole of the United States. It's referred to as extension. How do you see its role?
You know, extension is so important, and there's a national crisis in extension. There's no doubt about it. You know, I think some of the funding concerns that have happened here or have happened all over the land grant system. You know, I consider the extension folks to be the ultimate translators. You know, they're embedded in communities, and they have more direct contact with most of the citizens of the state compared to, you know, people that are centralized even in Champaign-Urbana. So to figure out how we catalyze that so that really they become the face and the voice of the college is really important to me. Some of the contacts that we have with future students happen firsthand with some of our extension personnel. The dissemination of our research work can happen there. So I know the state's been through a lot, and there's been a lot of concern about what a 21st century extension program looks like. But I had a chance to talk with the chancellor about this, and one of the best advantages for us with him is that he understands what extension is, and it means something to him. It was a big part of his career. It was a big part of my career as well. So I'm excited about what we might do together, but I do consider that to be a vital piece of what a land grant is, because that translation is really what makes us mission relevant. So we'll definitely be figuring out how to do a good job of making that extension network vibrant.
Kim Kidwell is the new dean of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. This is our Women in Agriculture edition. Up next, we'll talk with Colleen Callahan. She heads up rural development for the USDA in the great state of Illinois. I caught up with Colleen at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City and asked her just exactly what it is that rural development does.
USDA Rural Development has a mission of furthering advancements in rural communities, helping meet needs financially that potentially may go unmet. We have 43 different programs. They are categorized in housing, in community facilities, in business, as well as water and waste. So if a community needs a new storm siren, if it needs EMT equipment or a vehicle, if it needs a hospital, a clinic, anything that relates to a community need, we are able to help fund in a community that is 20,000 and under in population. For our housing programs, we have both direct loans and guaranteed loans. So we can make that direct loan as the lender. We are the only agency left that does not require a down payment. We can finance 100% of that home. And we can also guarantee that loan. So if you go to a bank and you qualify for their loan, that bank then may come to us and say, we'd like to guarantee this loan. We look at the same financials. If we think it's a good loan, we can guarantee it. And then again, we're talking a lower interest rate, longer life of the loan, and a down payment that doesn't have to be considered. And that's the deal breaker most of the time for people, is that 20% down payment. So rural development can really help in that regard. For our business programs, we partner with banks. So if there is a business in a community that is doing well but could do better if it had this new piece of equipment that costs $3 million, they could add jobs, they could produce more product, they could meet their demand. But the bank says, but it's a little iffy for us and it's a big loan for us. If Rural Development will guarantee that loan, yes, we're in. So we may become that bank's partner. We, again, look at the same financials. If we think it's a good loan, we can guarantee it 80, 85, 90%. What happens then is that the bank typically will reduce the interest rate. They may extend the life of the loan. And what that does for the lender is that they only have to put either 20, 15, or 10% of that loan on their books. And our small rural community banks don't have a great lending capacity like some of the larger urban banks do. So we become partners. And then as it relates to the water programs, Todd, you would know that most of our water lines in rural America were put in the 30s. Cast iron that's now rusted. Lines are like Swiss cheese. You lose water pressure. Communities lose their fire accreditation because the fire department can't guarantee they can put out the fire because they don't have the pressure. And maybe that water tower needs to be replaced as well. And that's millions of dollars. So I think what we do to answer your question more succinctly is that we've not forgotten our roots at USDA Rural Development. When Abraham Lincoln, who created the Department of Agriculture, said, as the people's agency, as the people's department, the legitimate object of government is to do for a community of people what needs to be done when they cannot do together or in their separate individual capacities. The translation of that to me is that what Lincoln said was that government doesn't come in and say and tell and do and show. Rather, who knows better what a community or a region needs than the people who live there? And when you've exhausted all of your resources, when you've gone to the foundations, when you've gone to companies, when you have held every last fundraiser, and you're still $1 million short to meet this need, maybe USDA Rural Development can help meet that need with that loan, with that low-interest loan right now at the lowest interest rates in history, or with a grant, or with a combination of the two. USDA Rural Development is a financial facilitator. We make possibilities possible.
Are there other government agencies that are your counterparts in urban areas that deal with housing or with development? And that are not in USDA, so why the 20,000 people in last limit?
HUD, of course, has housing programs. EDA, Economic Development, which is part of the Department of Commerce, yes, they also have programs. And we work in partnership with them as well. We have a good working relationship. Oftentimes, as an example, just a few weeks ago in the Quincy area, in what is the Great Region, which includes Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri, we worked together across those state boundaries and had a rural resource rally. And there was a presentation from all of these entities, over a dozen of them, who said, here's what we have. Can any of you help us fund this? So we collaborated. We worked together. And to answer your question, yes, there are other agencies that also have programs that can be of assistance. Ours are specifically designed for these rural communities of 20,000 and under, 10,000 and under, or 50,000 and under, depending upon the program.
Thank you so much, Colleen.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
Colleen Callahan is with Rural Development for the State of Illinois and USDA.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
It's Eat Vegetarian Day. It's also National Chocolate Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1763, John Molson was born. He was the founder of Molson Brewery in Montreal, Canada. In 1814, John Bennett Laws was born, an English agronomist. He initiated the artificial fertilizer industry, and he was the founder of the world's first agricultural research station. In 1842, he patented a method to make superphosphate by treating phosphate rock with sulfuric acid. 1 year later, he partnered with Joseph Gilbert to establish an agricultural research station where they studied animal nutrition as well as the effects of inorganic and organic fertilizers on crop yields. In 1869, William Finley Semple patented the first chewing gum made of, quote, the combination of rubber with other articles. But he never commercially manufactured the gum. That honor went to Thomas Adams. And in 1886, Josephine Cochran patented the first commercially successful dishwashing machine. She marketed the machine to hotels and restaurants, and the machine was a huge hit at the 1893 Columbian Exposition. Her company eventually evolved into KitchenAid. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers, helping farm families succeed for 100 years.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Do find us online at WILLAG.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming from the Closing Market Report to the Commodity Week and everything in between. Again, the address is willag.org. Do check out the calendar of events on that page. We'll be many places over the winter meeting season, and I hope to catch up with you at one of them. Now up next, in our second of a three-part series on the history of soybeans, we'll travel through the courtesy of retired University of Illinois plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz back to the first introduction of the soybean in the United States. That story begins prior to the Revolutionary War with a single individual who sailed the seven seas and brought the soybean to North America from China. In 1758, Samuel Bowen signed on as a sailor with a ship called the Pitt. He was an Englishman. The ship sailed to India and then on to Hong Kong. From there, says plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz, Samuel Bowen signed off the Pitt and onto a ship called the Success. Well, Heimowitz and a friend spent 2 years tracking Mr. Bowen's movements by researching the University of Illinois library. Anyway, the Success, says Heimowitz, sailed north from Hong Kong to Tientsin, China.
There, the ship was captured because the British were not supposed to be trading other than in Hong Kong, and the emperor was annoyed. The ship was never seen again, probably sunk. And Mr. Bowen and those people on the ship were held hostage, Mr. Bowen writes, for 3 years. He was held a hostage. And eventually imprisoned in Hong Kong. Actually, Macau, next door.
Samuel Bowen was eventually released and made his way back to the colonies, in this case, Savannah, Georgia. He brought with him a bag of beans, soybeans. It was the mid-1760s. Now, Mr. Bowen was something of an entrepreneur. In 1767, Bowen was issued a royal patent for soy sauce. He'd acquired some property in Georgia and was growing and pressing soybeans into sauce on a farm he called Greenwich. The sauce was grown for export to England.
And it was quite a business. He was an entrepreneur because he also had the idea of crushing peanuts for oil. And in fact, we have records that he did it. So he was an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, he died 10 years later, and in 1777.
Despite his death, Bowen had managed to leave a legacy. The soybean. The first recorded evidence of the bean in the United States belongs to him. The minutes from a 1765 meeting of the Philadelphia Society for the Promotion of Agriculture acknowledges the receipt of 6 bottles of soy and seeds of Chinese vetch from Samuel Bowen. And that is one story of how the soybean arrived in North America.
There are others, and Ted Heimowitz harbors one of them, but they cannot be proven. So it's a ship called the Success, Chinese imprisonment, and Samuel Bowen that are credited with the introduction of the soybean to North American farmers. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.